now at assescamps.ca.
Hey there, Kingston. Looking for the latest in arts and culture? Join me, Ellie Stern, Friday 3 to 4 p.m. for the Kingston Curator. Featuring interviews with artists themselves, I'll explore what's happening around town. From live music and theater to gallery shows, festivals, and more. Catch it live on CFRC 101.9 FM, stream at cfrc.ca, or listen anytime on the CFRC Podcast Network. The Kingston Curator, your backstage pass to Kingston's creative scene.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, I would like to introduce you to Gabby Toretto, who has just completed her Master's in Pathology and Molecular Medicine under the supervision of Dr. Scott Davey and Dr. Harriet Furlotta. Welcome to Grad Chat, Gabby, and congratulations.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me.
How does it feel knowing you've done?
It feels like a weight has been lifted off. I'm feeling pretty good, but also I'm staying here at Queen's for another year as well. So have some familiarity in the coming year too.
Well, that's great. I mean, I hate it when, well, I don't really hate it, but you know, there are times that not everyone wants to stick around. Once they're done, they're gone, which is really quite sad because I miss seeing our students around the place mm-hmm. and learning where they are in their research. So I'm glad you were able to sort of stick around. So with that then, why are you sticking around? What are you doing?
Very good question. So yes, I just finished my master's in November of 2024, and I'm staying as a research associate for another year with my lab, the same lab that I completed my master's work with, finishing off some loose ends that we had for my master's work, as well as trying out some new things, just like Grad Chat today.
That's perfect. Well, it must be hard, particularly in master's. You start a project and you don't always get to finish it, as you said.
Exactly.
Because you're only here for 2 years, and we all know research isn't always that quick.
Exactly. You go into it thinking that you're going to be doing one thing, and at least in my experience, I found that my project was constantly changing every day almost. So it's a very cool experience getting to immerse yourself in a field and figuring out that there are so many branching problems, branching questions that come out of those original research questions.
Well, I guess too, I mean, and we'll get into your project shortly, but I guess your project, was it started by someone else and you then took it over? Well, it's part of Dr. Davey's lab, of course, but I'm sure there's lots of things going on in that lab which mm-hmm. gets started by one student and then is taken over. Did that kind of happen for you?
Very similarly, actually. We had a summer student who was working throughout the summer before I started my master's, who found some interesting trends in terms of BRCA1, the gene, and variants within the gene as well. And we used that idea and we used that trend to develop my master's project. Myself, as well as a master's student, have now been working on this project into our master's.
That's brilliant. And I know probably people are probably saying, what's BRCA1? And we will get to that because it's going to be more clear mm-hmm. shortly. One more question before we do a bit more background. Why did you get into research in the first place? Did you do some in undergrad? Because some undergrad programs have a research component which gives you an inkling of what to expect, but not everyone then continues. Mm-hmm. Why did you want to?
Very good question. There's multiple factors that sort of led me to where I am today. Firstly, being I've always been interested in cancer research, given that I have a personal history with cancer through family,
right.
As anyone can relate to, I believe everyone has some sort of connection to cancer, be it through themselves or through family members. So I've always had that interest in learning more about what cancer is and the mechanisms behind it and what we can do as individuals to help progress the field.
Right.
So having also completed my undergrad here in life sciences at Queen's, I've been exposed to many different types of fields, including cancer. I remember I took a Cancer 380 course in my third year.
Oh, great.
And that exposed me to the mechanisms of cancer, the origins of cancer, the genetic aspect of cancer as well, which I thought was really cool. And in terms of research experience, I completed my 499 or my fourth year research project.
Right, right.
Under the supervision of Dr. Harriet Feilotter, who is now my supervisor in my master's program. And in that project, I looked on something a little bit different, but something related to what I did in my master's work. But we were looking at different mutations in tumors from lung cancer samples. So
right.
That's sort of what exposed me to the genetic aspect of cancer and what inspired me to continue on into a master's degree.
Well, I think we're so lucky here because we have the cancer research trials here, you know, mm-hmm. the Sinclair Cancer Research Institute.
Exactly, yes.
And for a university that's only medium size, we're really hitting above what we should be. And we have this great work that we do. And of course, people like yourself in pathology and molecular medicine, as well as biomedical molecular sciences, et cetera. It's just fascinating what we can offer here at Queen's.
Thank you.
Both for the community at large, but as well as our students getting an opportunity mm-hmm. to be a part of this. And we all know that, you know, a lot of us, as you said, have know people who have had various forms of cancer. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's lots of them, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And not all of them are shown the same way, which mm-hmm. is why we need a lot of research. But you're looking more about, well, let me give everyone your research topic, and then we'll sort of, if you can give some background a little bit as well, would
For
be
sure.
helpful. Now, I could give the proper title, which I'm going to tell people anyway, Assessing the Clinical Significance of BRCA1 BRCT Domain Variants of Uncertain Significance, in brackets VUS, end of bracket, or, thank you very much for coming back with another one, mm-hmm. Assessing BRCA1 Genetic Variants Involved in Hereditary Breast and Ovarian Cancer.
Still a mouthful, but
it's still a mouthful.
It's a little bit more digestible.
But at least you got the word cancer in there and hereditary and things. Because this is one of the things I always laugh about, particularly people in some of the STEM disciplines, some of the terminology. Who knows what that acronym is? But I know you're going to explain it to me. But that's the beauty, right? Mm-hmm. So changing how we do that. So why choose, I mean, maybe you didn't choose it, maybe it was Dr. Dave who chose it, but why choose looking at things like hereditary breast and ovarian cancer? Because I would imagine both of them are very different, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. So yes, they are completely different diseases. However, the reason why we're looking at them together is because in terms of hereditary cases of breast and ovarian cancer, the most common cause of these cases are germline or inherited variants or mutations in
right.
BRCA1 and 2 genes.
So they're just genes, they're not a protein or something? Because I hear all these other words, you know, proteins mm-hmm. and this and that.
It can be confusing at times to decipher, yes.
Right.
But BRCA1, it actually stands for breast cancer gene 1. So that's why called BRCA1, that the connection it has with breast and ovarian cancer. But yes, BRCA1 and 2 are genes. However, they code for proteins. And what these proteins do, the reason why BRCA1 and 2 are called tumor suppressor genes is because the proteins that they encode, they protect our genome. They serve as methods of preserving our genomic integrity through methods such as DNA repair. So it's very important that these genes are functional. And when we see that these genes are no longer functional in some people, they lead to significantly elevated risks of developing breast and ovarian cancer.
Well, that's a bit depressing, isn't it? It's usually the case, though, isn't it? Something that's there for good, if it doesn't work properly, mm-hmm. we're in trouble.
It can feel depressing at times. However, it does open up avenues for different targeted treatments or surveillance and things like that as well.
So with that, then, what is the prevalence of this?
Mm-hmm.
Of this, I guess, is it the prevalence of breast and ovarian cancer, or is it the prevalence of this particular gene getting blocked or not functioning properly?
Oh, good question. Yeah. So I can start off with a general picture of breast and ovarian cancer. So breast cancer is the most common cancer in Canadian women. Approximately 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in her lifetime, which is a very scary
statistic. That is scary for us women, yes.
Mm-hmm. Ovarian cancer, alternatively, is not as common as breast cancer. I believe it's the ninth most common cancer in Canadian women, although it is 3 times as lethal, mostly attributed to its later stage of diagnosis.
Right, right.
So the majority of breast and ovarian cancer cases, they're considered sporadic. However, a fraction of these, approximately 5 to 10% of breast and 20 to 25% of ovarian cancer cases are linked to inherited mutations in cancer susceptibility genes, the majority of which being BRCA1 and 2.
Right. Well, it's interesting too, because a little bit of personal thing here, mm-hmm. because we've had breast cancer in our family, mm-hmm. my GP gets me tested once a year.
Absolutely.
Now, yes. if I didn't have that in family history, it may only be every 2 years. Mm-hmm. So,
well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, so it's one of those things, I guess, that if you got it, you may be more susceptible without even knowing it.
Right. Given the link between BRCA1 and 2 mutations and the elevated risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer, that's what's led to the implementation of genetic testing, as you said, to identify carriers of these pathogenic BRCA1 and 2 variants. So in Ontario, I believe we have provincial guidelines that outlines eligibility requirements for women to obtain this sort of testing, such as a family history of breast or ovarian cancer, or having a known BRCA1 variant in the family, or even being of a certain descent, such as Ashkenazi Jewish women are at an elevated risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer with BRCA1 mutations.
So this isn't a normal going to have a mammogram. This is a different test altogether, because I think, you know, if you're having a mammogram, how can you get down to the nitty-gritty here? Because the mammogram is just showing you a possibility.
Right, right. This is a different type of test. So it's sort of clinical genetic sequencing. So we're sequencing, in this case, the BRCA1 gene, and we're scanning for alterations within this gene that could be benign, which means like they're not cancer-causing, or they could be pathogenic, which means that they have deleterious effects on BRCA1 and 2.
Right. So is this the Angelina Jolie thing when she knew she had hereditary genes, or mm-hmm. potentially she went and had another test and said she had the possibility? Is this what we're talking about here?
I'm glad that you brought that up, actually. Yes, the Angelina Jolie effect is what I believe you're referring to.
Yes.
And yes, so she had a pathogenic BRCA1 mutation. And because of this, she took different steps to reduce her risk of developing breast and ovarian cancer. So what I believe she did is that she had a double mastectomy, mm-hmm. as well as other prophylactic treatments to reduce her risk. And that's another reason why genetic testing has become so much more prevalent in women, is because women going into testing, if they have a positive test, meaning that they have a genetic variant that is pathogenic in BRCA1, they have the ability to take these management steps to reduce their risk, be it through enhanced surveillance, risk reduction strategies such as mastectomies, chemo preventative treatments as well. And for women who also have breast or ovarian cancer already, knowing that they have a specific mutation within BRCA1, it makes them eligible for different types of targeted therapies that have shown to be more effective for women with BRCA1 or 2 mutated tumors.
But is this kind of test, sorry, you may not know this, just the way my brain is working. So is this kind of test easy for women to go and have, cheap, easy to get in, mm-hmm. or is it only for those people who can afford it? And I mean, we don't want to tell everyone should go and have this test. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do we find that balance?
Good question.
Between just having a mammogram, which I'm glad more women are having now, mm-hmm. to going that next step of saying, well, it's been in my family, maybe I've got this gene, maybe I should go and get that tested too.
Right. So genetic testing has become more accessible in recent years, and that can be attributed to the development of next generation sequencing. So this is a sequencing technique that is a lot more affordable, that's a lot quicker, that opens a lot of doors for sort of precision medicine, in which we are able to pinpoint mutations within genes that can be targeted for cancer therapies or for surveillance methods.
Right.
So in terms of genetic testing, it has become more accessible in that way, and that has enhanced precision medicine in that way as well. However, with the increase in genetic testing, it's also resulted in a lot more of these discoveries of variants of uncertain significance, which
right. is great for you guys, because you go, yes, I can go and check that out as well. So let's just remind ourselves then of the function of this BRCA1 gene. So can you explain again what the function is of this?
Right. So BRCA1 is a pleiotropic or multifunctional gene that is involved in various methods of preserving genomic stability, primarily through a DNA repair process called homologous recombination.
Okay.
So BRCA1 is involved in a series of complex pathways that ensure that DNA is being repaired properly. Yes.
Which is important, right?
So, very important.
So if
yes.
that doesn't happen, that's when we get more mutations.
And that's what would lead to cancer.
Which would lead to cancer. Loving it. So far, I'm following, which is good.
Perfect.
Don't always, but I am. So thank you. And so tell us about what part are you playing in looking at this particular gene? What are you trying to do? Find out when it mutates or doesn't function properly, or finding out how it performs its function?
Right. So the problem that we're looking specifically at is variants of uncertain significance in BRCA1. So in a situation where a woman goes in for genetic testing, if she receives a VUS in her genetic test, meaning that there's a variant in BRCA1, or a mutation, I should say, that has an uncertain effect on gene function and disease risk, this leads to a lot of ambiguity in the results. And it's a very critical clinical problem, as clinicians are unable to effectively interpret these genetic testing results. Subsequently, it results in their inability to provide appropriate management steps to these women. And obviously, this is a very distressing situation for women who don't know their level of risk for developing breast or ovarian cancer.
So a mutation doesn't necessarily mean it's going to lead to cancer.
Exactly, yes.
So, which is why it's difficult for the physician to figure out is it's going to have a problem or not. Is that what you're saying?
So there's different types of mutations that can occur in any gene, including BRCA1. Some mutations, they're very minor. They may not affect the overall function of the protein that they translate. But there are other mutations that are much more significant that can greatly impact the functionality of BRCA1.
Right.
However, there are variants that are in that sort of gray region where we're not sure. Maybe it could affect it, maybe it couldn't. So that it's sort of that the range of a variant. It could be very benign or it could be pathogenic, but there's a gray region inside where we're not too sure of the effect that it has. And especially with BRCA1 being a multifunctional gene, which has many different roles, it becomes increasingly difficult to determine, yes, this one variant, one amino acid switch can actually cause an impactful change in its functionality.
So how are you finding this out, though? Is it a machine? Is it an algorithm? How are you trying to determine if there's an issue, where it is, and what it's doing?
Right. So a database that was very helpful for us, it's called ClinVar. So it's a variant classification database that has all pathogenic and benign variants across genes, including BRCA1, but a multitude of other human genes as well. This database also has a compilation of uncertain variants or VUSs in these genes as well. So we can see the distribution of benign variants, of pathogenic variants, and of VUSs as well. And there's a large spike in VUSs now, especially with the implementation of increasing genetic testing. So we can see where these variants are, but my master's work was dedicated to looking at different ways that we can actually assess these variants and determine their pathogenicity, both through computational methods as well as functional lab methods.
Ooh, computational.
Makes me shiver too.
Do you like math or you don't? Unfortunately, it is there, but luckily someone else usually does the algorithm for you. Yes. So we've clearly got a big database. Is that housed here in Kingston, or is it a Canadian database?
I believe it's an international database
where
different clinicians, different clinical labs can contribute to the database with findings of the pathogenicity of different variants that they're studying. So we're hoping to contribute to that database as well with the findings that we've found through my master's, as well as the additional work that we've been doing in our lab.
So if you can contribute whatever you find, what are you hoping to achieve other than to add more data to this database?
Right. So the overall goal of my research project, as well as our lab, is to enhance genetic testing for women. So if we contribute to this database, say that we are able to concretely identify a pathogenic variant that used to be identified as a VUS, clinicians are now able to effectively determine whether a woman is actually at an increased risk of developing breast or ovarian cancer if that woman has that variant in their BRCA1 gene. So hopefully through this research, we can better elucidate the impact that these variants have on gene function or BRCA1 gene functionality in order to enhance genetic testing for women and provide them with more clear steps in order to reduce their risk or improve their treatments.
It's improving treatments is clearly what we want to get to, but even knowing that they may have this one little variant, we all know everyone behaves differently. So how do you or the physicians take into account all other variables Because when you're looking at a treatment, you've got to take in all the variables around you, and one treatment doesn't fit everybody.
Exactly, yes.
So how do they get around that, just from learning that they've got this one little one?
Mm-hmm. So in previous years, it used to be a cookie cutter sort of situation for cancer treatments in which every cancer patient would have the same sort of treatments. However, in recent years, the field of medicine has moved towards precision medicine in a way that each patient is treated as an individual in which they have their own sort of fingerprint of what their cancer looks like, be it through specific mutations in a gene or in multiple genes. And this dictates how treatment can then be applied, because there are different sorts of targeted therapeutics, such as I mentioned maybe earlier about PARP inhibitors. PARP inhibitors work by targeting BRCA1 mutated tumor cells. So this sort of targeted therapy can be highly effective for women who already have a BRCA1 mutated tumor. So it enables for a diversification of the different types of therapies that can be given to patients, instead of that sort of one size fits all therapy.
Can you also look, my head is going everywhere. Can you also look, I mean, you might find this variant, mm-hmm. as we said, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to cause cancer. Mm-hmm. But if we find this variant in one person, can we then, the treatment be more of a preventative treatment to stop that mutating to a point where it does become cancer? Or am I totally missing the point there?
That's an interesting question. I'm going to have to think about that a little bit. The way that cancer develops in BRCA1 mutated people is that everyone inherits two copies of the BRCA1 gene along with every other gene that they have.
Right.
When they inherit a mutated copy that's no longer functional, they still have one copy that is functional.
Oh, well,
so
good.
They are still able to protect their DNA, perhaps not to the same extent that they would with two copies. However, they're still functioning. They're cancer-free because of this functional copy. However, as one ages, if this other functional copy of BRCA1 is no longer functional, mm-hmm. that's what leads to cancer. So I'm not too sure in terms of mm-hmm. preventative treatments with VUS. However, it does help with sort of the surveillance and ensuring that we catch cancer as early as possible in these people who have an elevated risk.
So you do pick up the fact that one might still be okay.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's great. Mm-hmm. That's great. Tick. Yeah, because it'd be nothing. I mean, I guess it's like, you know, someone's kidney, one kidney fails, you've still got another one that you can mm-hmm. use. Mm-hmm. So it's good that there's always a backup in our systems.
Absolutely.
So you're still helping this project?
I am, yes.
Okay. What part did you get up to? So for you now to wanting to be able to finish it off.
Sure. Yeah, I can give a little synopsis of the work that I was doing. So my master's project was really cool, such that it had two components to it. It had that scary computational side of it, as well as the functional side of it. So the computational side was, we had the vision that a computational tool that was tailored not only towards a specific gene, but towards a specific domain of a gene would proved to be highly effective in accurately predicting a variant within that gene as pathogenic or benign.
Oh, okay.
So what we did was we collected different in silico tools, which are different types of machine learning algorithms that measure different aspects of sequence variation, be it evolutionary conservation of a variant or biochemical impact of it. And so we collected all those together. We applied those tools to all known pathogenic and benign variants within BRCA1, BRCT domain.
Okay.
Once we had those scores, then we used a feature selection program. It's called Molecular Feast, which was actually developed here at Queen's by Dr. Trishkin, as well as the Renwick Lab. But what this program does is that it ranks tools by its discriminatory ability on two separate groups. So for our case, it identified the in silico tools that best discriminated between pathogenic and benign variants. So we basically found the most accurate tools among the ones that we identified. And from there, we were able to build a computational classifier with these best tools that was able to predict the pathogenicity of VUSs within this BRCA1 gene, which is very cool.
Wow. That was a lot that you learned in two short years.
I hope that made sense as well.
I find it fascinating how much you can accomplish in such a short time. Now, I know it helps that you've got these databases that can help you. Mm-hmm. So you're not actually having to collect samples. I call them samples yourself.
kind of thing.
A quote that I like is like, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. Like, I couldn't have done it without the support of the faculty here at Queen's, my professors and students as well. It's a very amazing environment to be in, especially with the cancer research department here at Queen's as well. It's a very cool.
Particularly, really cool you're looking at one little section, and there's so much more around it.
Right. Absolutely.
So much more around that could go wrong, unfortunately. No, that's fascinating, and I think it's lovely that you've been able to stay on for another year.
Right. And so, with this additional year, we're investigating some of the VUSs that we predicted as pathogenic or benign from our computational classifier as a basic test to see. Is our classifier actually accurate in predicting a pathogenic or benign variant? So what these lab experiments are doing is we're basically measuring the impact that these variants have on BRCT normal ability. And what BRCT does is that it binds with different proteins that are involved in homologous recombination or DNA repair.
Right.
So by actually investigating the impact that these variants have on BRCT's binding ability, we can then deduce if this variant is deleterious or not. And what we're seeing from our results right now is that they're aligning with the computational predictions, which
well,
is great to see.
That's nice to see, isn't it? There'd be nothing where you say, oh my God, we did all that wrong.
Definitely a sigh of relief.
What did we miss? Because it only takes one little thing, doesn't it, to sort of throw any sort of result off or potential result or some other variable that we hadn't considered.
For sure. With such a changing field as well, you always have to consider all the changing variables.
And I guess down the track, one of the things, whether it's this kind of lab or another lab or together, is, you know, once you find this, you know, why is it changing? You know, what's made one of these little two die off and not do its function, et cetera? But not necessarily just within our body, you know, we all know environment can have an impact. I mean, this one is hereditary. I understand that. But you can have a hereditary gene, but then the impact from outside can also have an effect on it, whether make it worse if you got the gene or not worse kind of thing. But either way. So there's a lot of variables you've always got to take into consideration because no one's constant.
Cancer, its nature is it's very multifactorial. There's many factors that go into it, both genetic as well as environmental, as you mentioned as well. So every cancer patient has a different sort of landscape in terms of how their cancer develops. And that leads to how their treatment should be and how they should be reacting to different types of treatments.
Food for thought. Okay. Well, that was awesome. So before we go, I do want to ask you a couple of things about what else you do.
Sure.
Because I know grad students are always very, very busy, but somehow they manage to find times to do other things. Like, I mean, I'm looking here, you volunteer with the pediatric unit at KGH.
I do,
That's
yes.
pretty neat. What made you want to do that?
Yeah, thank you very much. It's one of the most rewarding experiences that I've had here at Queen's and at Kingston. But I started this position about 1 or 2 years ago now. It started off as a one-time volunteer thing with the holiday events for the kids at KGH, and then it translated into a volunteer position that I enjoy going to every week. But it's basically visiting the floor and getting to play with kids as well, and it's so amazing to see just their resilience and being able to provide them with a little outlet as well outside of their treatment. It's something that I find is super rewarding and I love doing.
Well, I'm sure they love having you around. I mean, it always breaks my heart when I see kids in hospital. They should be out playing with their mates.
Me as well.
And having fun. So I'm sure they really appreciate you coming along each week. And then other things like everyone's getting into this bouldering rock climbing thing. I must be the only person in Kingston or at Queens that doesn't do it these days.
It's weird if you meet someone who hasn't gone. Yes.
So what got you into that?
I actually started about 1 or 2 years ago now too. It started off as a one-time thing with a housemate, and it's turned into quite a passion for me as well. I think it's, you know, the mix of having some sort of physical activity as well as some sort of problem solving of climbing up that wall.
That's a good, I love
adrenaline.
Puzzles.
Oh, exactly.
So I love puzzles. I always wonder whether I'd have the strength or the flexibility to get my leg up to the next point.
It's like a physical puzzle almost, yes.
Yeah. Oh. Physical might not work for me, but one day I will try it. And clay sculpting. So you're a bit of an artist.
Try to be. It started off as I was at Michael's for something completely irrelevant. And they were having a sale on a 10-pound block of clay. And I thought, you know what, my grade eight, my grade eight training of clay making can really come in handy here. So I've just been sort of doing a self-taught little clay making.
And, that's brilliant.
Have some clay making nights with friends too. It's a lot of fun and very therapeutic.
Well, there you go. We all need a bit of therapy every now and then. Gabby, it has been great chatting you. I do appreciate you coming on.
But thank you very much for having me.
Oh, no worries at all. And so that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Today on Wings, Suki Westling from The Babblery interviews Ricky Gard Diamond, a U.S. woman who authored the book Screwnomics, How Our Economy Works Against Women and Real Ways to Make Lasting Change. She became a columnist for Ms. Magazine, and she also started an alliance among feminist economists called An Economy of Our Own.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Money in the bank.
We tend to talk about economics as if it's a science like physics or chemistry. You are told that the Fed is doing this or Congress has enacted that in order to benefit us, the everyday people who take part in our economy. But the truth is, economics is closer to a story we tell, based on assumptions we make about what's important. Economists act as if the traditional plot we call the economy is made up of immutable elements, like there's a formula we can plug numbers into and get the answer.
Shame of shames, I ended up having to go to the welfare office. I was working full time, I was going to school, but I couldn't make my budget work and I needed help and knew it, just to feed my kids. I thought there was something terribly, terribly wrong with me.
But no, there is nothing wrong with you if the formulas don't add up in your household. Today's guest is not an economist, but she did write a book about economics, inspired by her observation that the traditional economic stories we tell ourselves leave out the experiences and needs of over half of our population, women as well as other marginalized people.
Hi, I'm Ricky Gard Diamond, author of a book that was aimed at women and the economy. Got a nice review from Kirkus that said it was a smart, comprehensive economics guide with a feminist twist. And I love that feminist twist, by which I think they meant the title, which was Screwnomics, How the Economy Works Against Women and Real Ways to Make Lasting Change.
The title is definitely eye-catching. That's the first thing I noticed. I just read an article by you on the Ms. Magazine website, and I think that's what caught my attention. It's like, oh, this is a good piece. And I looked down, it's like, Screwnomics, what's that?
Well, it's actually a word I had to invent because of the widely applied but unspoken economic theory that women should always work for less or even better for free. That seemed to be everywhere, but no one was talking about it openly.
Yeah, we're going to touch on a variety of ways of looking at this. But I thought I'd start by playing devil's advocate.
Okay.
And the devil's advocate says, more women than ever are working and working full time. A larger share of mothers with children under 18 are working. Women slightly outnumber men in the college-educated workforce.
Yes.
And in graduate programs, women now outnumber men 1.6 to 1. So, Ricky, what the heck is the problem?
Well, I think a lot of people view it that way. But let's take a look at the wage gap. It continues to be universal, whatever the the industry or the work area, it's universal. And it doesn't matter if it's a female-dominated field or a male-dominated field, it is still a universal theory applied to women's wages. Mm-hmm. Here in the United States, when you're talking about 71 cents to a man's dollar, when you multiply it out over a year's time, it adds up, which is what Equal Pay Day is always about.
There's research on all of this, of course. People can go look up the numbers. But one thing I read was what would happen to the U.S. GDP if we evened that gap?
Yes.
Which is astounding. The numbers are just astounding, shocking. And the other is that, isn't it true that there's also a persistently larger wage gap between women-dominated professions and men-dominated professions, and even larger still, women of color-dominated
positions? All those baked-in striations are there in the wage gap. I hear a lot of talk about addressing, what do they call it, the post-colonialist economy, the gap between white men and white women is something like 80 cents to the dollar. But when you look at a Native American woman, it's 51 cents on a dollar. Black women are 64 cents on a dollar. Latinas are at 54 cents on a dollar. And so those baked in differences within each of the work areas are still very apparent. For instance, if you looked at the healthcare industry, where women are like 80% of the workforce. When you look at that field, you're going to find white women in the management positions, and the lowest paid ranks are going to be filled by brown and black women. And that's just baked in across the economy.
Just dipping our toes lightly into the weeds of feminist economic theory, it's important to be clear about the origins of our legal system, which derives from legal concepts developed over hundreds of years. When we create new legal structures, such as economic systems, we build them on top of existing law and very seldom do a wholesale reconstruction of what came before. And what came before was not great for women. American women were legally considered property until the mid and late 19th century. So women's labor in the home was a marriage benefit to a man, not valued labor provided by women. Like all the economic stories we tell, we've made a choice to continue to devalue labor that women exclusively provide. And there's no field of labor unique to people with uteruses other than pregnancy and birth. Ricky Gard Diamond points out that the gestation and birthing of babies is work. It's hard work that benefits our society, and yet we expect women to do it for free.
Women are not at the front of people's minds when they think about the economy. They think we're doing okay. And yet they aren't thinking about, here's one little basic thing. Women have to take off time and often work part-time because of their other responsibilities as birth givers and mothers. And the ones that still have their roles defined as, you know, caring and organizing the home front. The child care tax credit that was enabled during the COVID period showed us that giving poor families regular check, a monthly check, raised kids out of poverty at, you know, something like is half the poverty rate in the nation. And yet we couldn't afford to maintain that. So that homework that women do, that birthing work that women do, continues to be invisible in this economy. And in fact, we not only do this work for free, we pay for the privilege. In European countries, the average cost of giving birth is $10,000. And most of those costs are covered by national health insurance. Mm-hmm. Here in the United States, the average birth cost is around $30,000. So we pay for that privilege.
I want to point out something that you said that was really interesting. You said that there's a universal theory behind women's experiences being excluded from the economy, and that's provocative.
Well, I don't know that it's an unspoken theory. But I had to call it a theory because it's so widely applied. It's so universal.
Mm-hmm.
So I named it a theory. I don't know that it's written anywhere except in Scronomics, but...
But it does seem to be.
It does seem to be.
Yeah.
And it's clear from the work that women are still expected to do and are the work that is devalued because it's done by women and because it's concerned with, you know, caring, taking care of, maintaining relationships, making sure everybody has dinner and are happy at the dinner table, although we're not eating at the dinner table as much as we used to. But nevertheless, women carry that weight to a greater degree. I mean, all of the statistics point to that. And that devaluation of what's really at the foundation of any economy is not only hurtful to women, but also to the whole economy. I think you said earlier that what would happen to the GDP if we just addressed that women's pay gap? We'd see this enormous growth. And yet the past 20 years, we haven't seen that pay gap diminish. It's actually grown a little bit. Why is there this resistance to doing what seems to be a fairly simple thing?
Mm-hmm.
Now, young women are approaching equity in pay to a greater degree than was true for our generation, but it remains there and it's supported by statistics in every realm.
One of the things that I know that we saw was what happened to the economic health of the country when poor families received some support during the pandemic for their children. Can you talk a little bit about why it would actually help our economy as a whole if mothers were supported that way in general?
Women's wages, and in fact, parents' wages combined, have a difficult time paying for children. USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, puts out an annual figure for what it costs to raise a child to age 18, not counting college costs. And it's up to about $750,000 per child. So it's not surprising that we have the high rate of poverty for kids in this country. So during COVID, we sent them a monthly check based on their work. And it cut the poverty rate for kids in our country about in half. And yet, in the same way that we resist equalizing women's pay, we decided that, oh, we can't afford that. We're not going to do that anymore. And wouldn't you know it, our child poverty rate is a little bit higher than it was before COVID, and it's right back where it was before. So the solution is staring us right in the face, and yet we choose not to fund that.
Ricky Gard-Diamond's book, Scronomics, points out that economic theory is written to sound as if it's inevitable, but it's not. As a society, we make choices about what we value. I asked how women's experiences, both traditional and modern, are reflected in the economic picture presented by our government in its assessment of such numbers as the gross domestic product or the unemployment rate.
They're just not in the picture anywhere. They're not a commercial activity. We only fund commercial activities where profits can be made. That's a deliberate result of we only create dollars from debt. If you look at the dollar bill, you know, it has president's pictures on it, and it has the treasurer and lots of signatures here. But at the very top of the dollar bill, it says Federal Reserve Note. Well, what is a note? A note is essentially a bill, which is why we call these dollar bills. They are created out of debt. Debt means profit, means the interest from loans that are made. That's what we choose to fund. Mm-hmm. So women having babies or forests growing trees don't count until you can cash them in on the labor market or cut them up into lumber.
On Wings, Suki Westling from The Babblery interviews Ricky Gard-Diamond, a U.S. woman who authored the book Scronomics, How Our Economy Works Against Women and Real Ways to Make Lasting Change. She also started an alliance among feminist economists called An Economy of Our Own.
When I was working on my book, I came across a number of really brilliant women who had been thinking much more seriously about the economy than I had been, and who had great solutions to all kinds of economic questions I was addressing. For instance, we were talking about the GDP earlier, and a woman named Rianne Eisler, who's maybe familiar to some of your older listeners for her book, The Chalice and the Blade, and she also has a book called The Real Wealth of Nations. And she's talking about including in measures beyond the GDP, those things that we have been talking about that are now not even on the table. Another example would be the wonderful woman Ila Bhatt in South India, who organized with a union the self-employed women of India and imagined their organization not as a pyramid with a CEO at the top of the pinnacle, but as a growing living banyan tree with all of these leaves and that are, were the individuals, and then all of these branches that were connected to these trunks, which banyan trees have more than one trunk, that go down to the earth. And I was just so struck by that whole notion of envisioning a living economy. And because I discovered all of these women, I invited many of them to join me in forming a kind of alliance of feminist thinking about the economy. And that's what an economy of our own is. And if you go to our website, you'll see we have a marvelous advisory board that includes Rianne Eisler, includes Mary Beth Gardam, who's with the Women, Money, and Democracy Committee of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. You'll see Katanya Hart, who is with the West Virginia NAACP and a national board member for the National Organization for Women. You'll see Carmen Rios, who is a feminist rock star, digital wonder. We bring together women around an economic issue because part of the problem with the economy is that there are so many pieces. How do you think about it? It's hard to think about it as a whole. You have to kind of take apart the pieces that matter most to you, that have the most personal relevance to you at a particular time. We start out by asking them a really personal question. How on earth did you ever come to a place where you're thinking about investing, for instance? Each of them tells their own personal story and why it matters to them, why it became important for them. And we've touched on other subjects like union organizing, mutual support. Mm-hmm. One of our wonderful conversationalists, Carolyn Shanaz Hossein, she's the former president of the International Association for Feminist Economics, which is a global organization, and has written a number of books about the Southern Hemisphere of the world, which has a much more humanized economy with lots of mutual support that we don't see here in the Northern Hemisphere as much. Mm-hmm. So the women there have just been wonderful. It's been a real privilege for me to begin, even after finishing Screwnomics and discovering a number of these women and talking about the solutions they have, to expand that research and those conversations at an economy of our own has been so valuable to me mm-hmm. personally. And I think to a growing number of women who understand that what we're trying to do is make what is deliberately made complicated, understandable, and relevant to actual living lives, and most importantly, what we can do to change what's now a system that is essentially waged as war. It's a patriarchal structure that expects to create kings, and it does, but we want to see an economy waged as life, and we often say that.
I noticed that a lot of the topics that you cover are definitely unusual for an economic forum. You had one on economic trauma and another one on community well-being. Why do you think these topics are of particular interest to women and that it's women economists bringing them up?
Not so long ago, the idea of combining the words feminism and economics together was essentially laughable. But I think that's where the real solutions lies, including the planet, all of the life of the planet, and the life that women are charged in our society, charged with taking care of, that are devalued because they're doing that work that needs to be lifted up. Rhianne Eisler has said we need to put things right side up. It's like it's all backwards. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful cake diagram that Hazel Henderson, and one of the wonderful women I discovered in my research, it was the first economic graph that really made sense to me. And it was this big cake that had several layers. The bottom layer she named the nature layer. On top of that was a layer she called the love layer. Then there was this thin filling that was called the illegal layer. Then there was the nonprofit layer. And then there was the commercial layer up top. And on that was the frosting, which you could think of as the 1% there, the frosting all on top. And some of that cake is monetized, but a great deal of that cake is not monetized. Mm-hmm. Now, part of the discussion is, well, do we want to monetize it? Do we want to make everything commercial? There are those people on Wall Street that are now talking about buying natural assets, actually purchasing and making a commodity the biological functions of clean water or healthy soil. Do we want that? Or do we want to be innovative in other ways that look more radically at the whole notion of, I'm talking for myself now, lately I've been thinking about this whole notion of profit and whether we see this in nature. Do we see exchanges being anything but equal, back and forth from one form to another? There are those people who are working on nuclear fission who believe they can create this extra energy, but I don't see it in the world around me. And I'm wondering in what ways we can redefine profit. Is it only money, or can we, as some investors are doing now, can we also think of wealth as invested in our communities and their well-being and in the sustainability of the businesses that we have in place? And are they good for the planet and good for people? So that kind of triple bottom line, profit, people, planet, I think we need to look at that more closely and challenge what is now only something called shareholder value. That is the utmost good in the current economy that has given us money kings. One of the Scandinavian countries that are much more forward thinking about these issues than we are, they give like a full year's parental leave for bonding with your baby. And the mother cannot get her leave taken unless her partner also takes his. There's a wonderful organization called the Banker Ladies, which is one of Carolyn Hossein's projects. African immigrants to Canada were often discriminated against by traditional banks. And so they would form mutual aid groups based on relationship where people chip in a certain amount of money regularly, and then that money is available to members of that group. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an informal banking system. Mm-hmm. There can also be an exchange of services. There are things called time banks that also enable people to exchange work with one another. I took advantage of a time bank in recent years when I had a leak in my roof and I had to cut out a piece of the drywall. A lovely older woman came over to show me how that was done, and she helped me with the whole project. In exchange, I didn't give her anything. She did this willingly because she had offered her services through the time bank. And I had other services that were available at the time bank that were available to all the members of that time bank.
Public banking is something that I was only vaguely aware of before my conversation with Ricky Gard-Diamond. But once I looked it up, it's one of those ideas that illustrate best her assertion that our economic system is not inevitable.
I learned about this by reading a wonderful book by Ellen Brown is based on The Wizard of Oz, and it explained a great deal about how our money is produced commercially for commercial purposes. And using that same system that is in existence now to create local banks, state banks. In the United States, there's one example of public banking, and that is in North Dakota, a very red state. But 100 years ago, farmers and other citizens got together and created a state bank, a bank owned by the state, operated by the state for social purposes. They were the first bank in the nation to create student loans for college and student loan forgiveness as well. But they also funded very small businesses, which often have a hard time getting finance from larger banks, and also farmers. They have been operating for 100 years with a social purpose, answering to the public for their activities, being much more transparent, and actually returning profits to the people, reducing taxes in that state, because it's the state that owns the bank. Women entrepreneurs are often a part of that community that gets ignored by the larger banks. And there is a movement now across the country where people are organizing to create a network of public banks that fills in a gap that can really make a difference. So we're very much behind that effort and have even had a couple of what we call learning circles, which are a little more intense educational experience focused on a single issue.
The history of feminism started with women exchanging stories and finding common themes. Ricky Gard Diamond's experiences are her own, but they are not isolated from the experiences of other women.
I think I'm here because I still have compassion for what I saw in that welfare office and the layers of privilege that were evident, you know? One of the mainstays of our organization and economy of our own, and in my own research, is including diverse voices, because I not only want women to claim their own economic story, but their own economic expertise, because if you're alive in this country, you've been using it. And I think when women get together and talk about what's going on in their lives, and understand that what is so difficult to understand is actually deliberate and not all that complicated when you really look at it closely, it hasn't always matched up with what the Dow is saying about the economy, but it is important.
This conversation offers a lot of food for thought. We're running an economy designed for a well-off, white, Victorian family with a working father at the head and homemaker providing free labor at home. That world is largely past, yet the ways we measure our economic health were designed in and for that world. Ricky and I only touched on some of the solutions that the women of An Economy of Our Own speak about, so I highly recommend you check out the links on Babbelry.com. And for more information, visit aneconomyofourown.org. The song Money in the Bank by Carcy Blanton is courtesy of freemusicarchive.org. Thanks for listening.
This show is excerpted from an interview by Suki Wessling, found on her podcast site, Babbelry.com. The guest was Ricky Gard Diamond, author of the book Screwnomics. Economists such as Rhianne Eisler, Ella Bott, and Ellen Brown can be heard in the Wings archives. For information, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
What's up? It's Pickles. We have a message.
Let's have a kiki. Get ready for a fabulous time with dragshow.com.